Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I am Renee Coleman, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire, with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man.
Hey.
How have you been?
I've been good, man.
Really?
We've been like ships passing in the night. You know, you were all occupied there with the restart of school. You had a million textbooks to secure and pass out to the little mush-headed children over there.
Yeah, and that's what they are.
And then I was out on the road. Just
you
as you were
out on the road,
getting freed up. I was all over the road with Sonny Landreth and the Iguanas, traveling through the Midwest, barnstorming, as I like to say, playing the House of Blues in St. Louis, Fitzgerald's.
Oh. Where is the original House of Blues? Is that Chicago?
That's a good question.
No, when there's many of them.
No, I said House of Blues. I meant to say City Winery. That's kind of the new version. City Winery is like the new House of Blues. It's much less folk art and many more seats. Everybody gets a seat. It's the same crowd, but everybody wants to sit down now.
Age appropriate.
But yeah, where's the original House of Blues? That's a good question. Boston, maybe?
I have no idea. They're like a chain now. I would think Chicago would probably be the place.
I played the Chicago House of Blues one time. I played the L.A. House of Blues. That used to be like right across from the Hyatt House, the Riot House.
Yeah, the House of Blues right there on Sunset Boulevard. Yeah.
Yep.
I went and the last time I was at the House of Blues in L.A., for some reason I went with my mom and her boyfriend to see that gospel brunch.
Oh, okay.
And they were from New Orleans, the gospel choir.
Oh, all right.
And I'll never forget, I mean, I didn't really, you know, the food was all right, you know, the gospel was all right. But I met Joey Buttafuoco there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was he doing?
That's a good question.
Was he just attending as
he was there watching the gospel?
Patron,
singers.
Okay.
Yeah.
You recognized
Joey
him?
Yeah, I recognized him, and I started chatting him up, and he seemed nervous at the time. And then we kind of bonded a little bit, as you do, over brunch.
Okay.
Bottomless mimosas.
Yeah, sure.
Talk about car repairs.
Yeah, talk about car repairs and... kiddie porn and stuff like
sure.
that.
Sure. Brunch fair. Brunch chat.
Wired jaws and stuff like that. Anyway, he seemed like a nice enough guy. We didn't exchange numbers or anything.
He didn't keep up after that.
We didn't keep up after that. But it was a good, like, 20-minute conversation.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, he really, I mean, he is Joey Buttafuoco. Back then, is he still alive?
I don't know.
I don't know Joey Buttafuoco.
Now, did they say married him? And what was the Joanne? Was that her name? What was her name?
The one who
Mary
got shot.
Mary Beth. Mary Joe.
Mary Joe Buttafuoco.
That's what. Yeah.
And who was the shooter? What was her name? God, I can't remember. It's like so.
Oh yeah. Everybody's in the listening audience is screaming.
Yeah. So, I don't remember her name, but she wasn't a very good shot, apparently.
No. No.
You know, it's kind of like the Trump assassins.
Thankfully.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway,
those guys are 0-2 so far, man. It's a tough season for a lot of teams, man.
Yeah.
Tough start to the season.
But they divorced, though, didn't they?
I guess they did.
I think because, And he was a plumber or a mechanic? He was a mechanic.
He was a mechanic.
Right. And she used to come by and check out the parts.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
Whatever the girl's name was, whatever the shooter
was.
Yeah,
I want to say Heidi Fleisch, but that was not.
No.
But same similar
same
period.
Yeah, similar period, you know. I met Heidi Fleisch, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the wife and I, when the first time I took the wife out to L.A., I was taking her to Hollywood, and this is after the whole Madam thing, you know, went through, and Heidi was kind of like old news. She had opened a lingerie shop on Hollywood Boulevard.
Okay, I do remember
and
that.
And we went in there and we chatted, you know, talked to her a little bit and, you know, looked at the lingerie. But I think that store lasted maybe 6 months. I don't think they did well. And then she moved to the desert.
Yeah, well, remember she was with that actor, the guy that was in Something Down, the helicopter movie, and Mogadishu, and you know who I'm
Black
talking
Hawk
about.
Down.
Black Hawk Down, yeah.
I think
you know
that's
that
what it was
big,
called.
Big tall actor. He's a good actor, but he
I forget
he,
his name.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah,
though.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, he
but she moved to the desert.
Okay.
With her birds. Apparently she's got thousands of birds.
Toucans and that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, parrots, toucans. You know, cockatoos.
Okay.
You know, those kind of birds.
You like those kind of birds, man? You like birds that talk, make a lot of noise, fly around the house, out of the cage?
I've never experienced much of that.
Yeah.
I think I could get used to it, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it would bother me.
I don't know. But you know who's got a great story about a bird, a minor bird, is Billy Bob Thornton.
Oh, okay.
He had a minor bird, apparently, when he was single.
Now, those talk, right?
Yeah, that's and they can converse with you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they'll have conversations with you.
Like, you think they know what they're talking about, or they just say phrases like AI? They just
I don't know, but apparently, this was when Billy Bob's career was just kind of starting in L.A. I heard this story a few years back, and he had a minor bird, and he had this girlfriend, but he also had this roommate, this guy, roommate. So Billy Bob, like, leaves the house to go on auditions or go to his job, whatever, and the girlfriend's gone. And apparently he comes home, and his minor bird is going, God, I hate that fucking bitch. I can't stand that fucking bitch. And his roommate was saying that out loud, I guess, talking on the phone with somebody about Billy Bob's girlfriend.
Oh, man.
And the minor bird just kept repeating it, and he figured it out, that his roommate didn't like his girlfriend.
Huh, okay.
Because the bird... you know, said things like that.
Right.
You know, repeated things.
See, I would think it would be like Ed McMahon, you know, just like kind of agree with everything. Like, yes, Mr. Thornton, you're absolutely correct.
Right.
Funny once again, Mr. Thornton.
But I don't know. I had a great aunt who had some birds, and I used to see her once every summer when I was a kid. And the birds were kind of cool. They would say things, you know.
Yeah.
You ever go to that car wash on Top Chapatulas? Over there,
I know
by the Wendy's.
Not in a long time. I know which one you're talking about.
Well, they have. If you go in the lobby and hang out there, they've got tons of exotic birds.
Really?
There. Yeah, they're really cool.
Huh? Okay.
You know,
you go to that car wash?
Yes, I do.
You like it? You're satisfied with the?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's hit or miss. I just don't understand why it costs so much to have your car washed. It's like $35.
Oh, geez.
You know, it's like they have like three different levels of car washes. Right. 30, 40, 50. It's like...
Holy moly.
It's like, you know, I'm from L.A. where we have a water shortage every year, and car washes are like $8.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't understand why it's so expensive down here.
Well, you know, that's a very... that's some of the most expensive real estate in the city right over there, close
to
that.
My wife was saying that the owner of the car wash who owns that oil place too also owns a bunch of land over there, and there's some historic property there too.
Okay. But what I meant by that was that the people that live around there are the richest in the city.
Oh, really?
So they can afford to pay those kind of prices. For a time the vet I was going to was over there, and he's a great vet.
You see a vet?
Well, I mean, yeah. When the staff physician can't get me in, squeeze me in, I have a vet I go to. You know, if I take a bullet after hours, you know. But no, when I had a dog back when I had dogs, but at some point he just priced himself. It's like I can't afford to. I don't spend that kind of money on maintaining myself. I can't spend that kind of money on a pet. So
see,
anyway.
My wife goes there because she gets. If you get an oil change there, you get a free car wash.
Okay.
You know. But with my car, I don't need to get an oil change. I just go to the dealer to get the oil.
Oh, yeah. You have like 6 years of maintenance on your car or something
seven
crazy?
Yeah, 7 years
seven
of total
years.
Maintenance.
Wow. Bumper to bumper.
Bumper to bumper.
Yeah. Volkswagen's putting out a good product. You're still happy with that vehicle?
I'm happy with that.
Nice.
Them,
nice.
So what's been going on?
What's been going on? So, yeah, I was out on the road, came back for a couple of days, and then... Went back out with the Iguanas and Sonny Landreth. Started out at the Iridium in New York City, which was Les Paul's home club that he played in every, whatever, Monday night or something for multiple years, 15, 20 years or something.
Now, who is Les Paul again?
Les Paul is the guy who, he was a great guitar player, had the duo with Les Paul and Mary Ford. They were recording artists. She played guitar as well, and they'd play all these... like in the 40s and 50s, these duo guitar records, instrumental records. But then he also invented the electric guitar. by you know, amplifying a putting a magnetic pickup into inventing the solid body guitar for sure by making.
So he's to blame for everything, right?
And he's to blame for a lot. Yeah, he also invented multi-track recording by taking. By putting a whole bunch of single track recordings together and syncing them all.
Right.
No, he was quite. Another interesting thing about Les Paul is after he had a career, he's, you know, well known, maybe in his 30s or something, late 20s, he had a car accident, and the car accident crushed his right elbow, and it was like beyond repair. It was not going to function anymore, and the doctor said, "Look, we can set your arm in one position. It's going to heal in that position, and you're not going to be able to move it." He said, "Well, set it in this position." Position to bent to play guitar.
Strumming.
So his right arm was the elbow would not bend. That's it was in permanently healed in guitar playing position.
Are you sure that was for guitar, not jerking off?
Well, I guess it did double duty. You know, maybe that was just his excuse. But
now, was he married to this girl?
I think he was married to Mary Ford. I'm not sure if she passed away. I really don't know a lot about his personal life. But I was playing there with the Iguanas and Sonny Landreth, and it's right there on, like, I don't know, 49th Street or something. It's on and Broadway. It's right at the heart of the action. Now, it seems like every time I'm in New York now, I just get in on one day, play the gig, and then have to leave the next day. So it was a very brief sojourn there. But then I went and played in the D.C. area and State College in Pennsylvania, where Jerry Sandusky did some of his best work, apparently.
Oh.
But wasn't involved in that side of it. We played a great old theater there. And so it was a successful little run. Did that, some packed houses, standing ovations. Now it's always a shock when I'm out on the road. I might have said this before that it's kind of like being on dope or something. Is that all of your problems are replaced by one problem, which is your only problem on the road is getting to the gig and playing the gig. So everything you do is geared to that. And you get back to New Orleans, like, well, you have many issues you have to deal with. There's right. a long laundry list of things.
But isn't another problem, like, someone has gas in the van while you're going around?
You know, that's not really a problem. It's
okay. Everyone's cool with it.
I mean, I don't ever notice anybody passing gas in the van. I mean, very rarely, you know. People usually stop and go to the bathroom. You know, it's you can roll a window down, I suppose. You know, but that's not a big issue for me. But I'm taking off this Sunday to go out with Sonny again this Friday, actually playing Saturday in Macon, Georgia, as part of the Georgia Allman Brothers Association Guitar Slide Guitar Summit. It's a mouthful, as my son said. But
sounds really awesome.
it should be cool. Sonny's the headliner there, so I'm traveling in rarefied company. I find myself, you know, I'm playing the Iridium with Sonny Landreth. I'm looking at myself going, I must be doing something right,
yeah.
I don't know. I've got Manny Chevrolet here. I'm back in the bosom of the Troubled Men podcast. It's all clicking along. And speaking of things that we've been trying to accomplish, I'm sure you saw the photograph of the Bosco that I sent you.
Yes, thank you, my Bosco.
I acquired the Bosco.
Yes, where is the Bosco?
The Bosco, it's an interesting story.
You lost the Bosco?
Well, I haven't lost it, but the Bosco is not in my possession right now because when I flew back to it, now hold on, it's you're going to get it. As I flew
you
back.
You lost it in baggage handling?
No, because I didn't check a bag, so I couldn't put the Bosco. It's like 22 ounces. You know, you can't carry it on carry-on luggage. So I had to hand the Bosco off to the drummer, Brian Brignac, who doesn't live in New Orleans. He lives in Gonzales. So currently the Bosco is in Gonzales. Now, our guest, Danny, do you know what Bosco is?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, Manny, why don't you fill the listeners
Bosco
in on Bosco? Bosco
is your chocolate syrup that I grew up with.
Oh, okay. I do know what Bosco is.
You know what
Bosco
is.
Now you remember it?
Yes. All right, yeah. It's all
so is this guy going to take my Bosco?
No, so
he's not using any of the Bosco.
No, we're keeping it closed. The seal, the factory seal, is going to be intact. But he had checked baggage, so he's bringing it to Gonzales. He's going to meet me in Atlanta as we go to Macon this weekend. He's going to bring the Bosco. He's going to hand it off to me, and I'm going to bring it back to New Orleans. So we will have the Bosco for you on Sunday. I'll be able to deliver it to you.
I was really looking forward to the Bosco.
I know. Well, you know, sometimes the waiting is the hardest part, man. That's what they say. Yeah. Or as Lou Reed said, first thing you learn is you always got to wait. And I was really hoping to get it back, and it just the way it worked out, you know. But it's have no fear. We're going to deliver on the Bosco promise.
All right. Well,
maybe we should get our guest in here.
Well, wait a minute.
Okay.
There's things that have been happening.
Okay.
You know?
Sure.
You know, were you able to see that last debate?
I did see the debate. Yeah.
I didn't see much of it, but I do remember that the next day Democrats were very alarmed because of the way Biden's performance was just watching it. They were alarmed.
as a spectator.
Yeah, well, just as the president, you know, spectating the debate, they were very alarmed, and so a lot of shit happened after that, but I guess he didn't watch it very well. Maybe he dozed off or something.
Okay.
You know, and other things are going on. You know, that rap mogul, Diddy P.
Right.
He's facing life in prison, man.
Yeah, yeah, it's some crazy shit. Well, I mean,
which is also known as the Rap Hall of Fame.
Okay. He'll be in good company, you're saying. Well, you know, if the allegations are true, it's shocking that he got away with it for so long.
Well, I think he's going to kill himself.
Ooh, you think he's going to be Epstein?
I think he's the Black Epstein.
Okay.
I think that's what it comes down to, because all of a sudden, all these celebrities are shying away from him.
Yeah, they're all taking
all
a side
his
step.
Friends, yep. You know, right. Like Leonardo DiCaprio.
Okay.
They're like, oh, I never was there, you know, even though
there's pictures of everything.
Yeah,
they have tons of footage.
Yeah.
That was
Justin
the whole thing.
Bieber, all these
the white parties, isn't that where everybody dressed in white?
Right.
I remember those. That was a big deal.
Yeah. And also a sad thing that happened this past week, and then we can move on.
Okay.
I want to talk about Tito Jackson.
Okay.
Tito Jackson passed away last week.
Oh, man. I missed that. I saw that he was in the news, but I missed.
Yeah.
I was so
he died
distracted.
Somewhere in like Oklahoma or Arizona or something like that. But people don't realize that Tito was the true talent of that band.
Okay.
In fact, there was a book that came out. I remember reading it back in the late 80s, early 90s, called The Tito Factor.
Mm-hmm.
The Tito Factor.
He was a guitar player.
And he, people don't realize this. Everyone thinks the dad, what was the dad's name? Joe Jackson?
Joe.
Was the one who got this band together and trained them and rehearsed them. But it was Tito.
Hmm.
Tito was the one. While Joe was beating the shit out of the wife, it was Tito who was doing the dance moves with Michael and the rest of the band, was doing the harmonies and stuff like that. It was
the Tito
Jackson, man, and may he rest in peace.
Yeah, man, shout out.
He was a friend of mine.
Right on.
In fact, in the book it says, remember how that song "I'll Be There" by the Jackson 5?
Right.
And legend says that Quincy Jones, who was producing, told Michael to say, "Just look over your shoulder." You know, that was like Quincy Jones' input to that song.
Uh-huh.
But really, it was Tito.
Oh.
Tito said, "Michael, look over your shoulder. Dad's got a belt." You know, so that's why he said that in that song.
I see. All right.
You know, Tito Jackson. And if you could pick up that book, it's an amazing book.
That
I don't know if it's still around.
That sounds good.
The Tito Factor.
Tito Factor. Yeah. I saw Tito Jackson play maybe about 10 years ago at Family Gras out there on Veterans Expressway at Metairie.
Oh.
Yeah, he was good. I was playing on the same bill. I think I was playing there with the Iguanas or something.
Nice.
We hung around. We were playing a side stage. He was playing an early slot on the main stage. No, he gave it to the people, man. He was he came out and delivered. All right, well, yes, rest in peace, Tito Jackson. Okay, well, let's get to our guest here, huh?
Maybe he's got my Bosco, Tito Jackson.
Well, you're definitely not getting it back now. You're gonna I'd set my sights, my hopes on the Bosco that's currently in Gonzales, Louisiana. I have a good feeling about that.
You know, they have a Jack in a Box in Gonzales.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the farthest East Coast Jack in a Box. East.
Oh, are you a fan of Jack in the Box?
I grew up, you know, Jack in a Box.
That's a West Coast product.
Yeah. Okay. Jack in a Box is very West Coast. They were, you know, they have chains there. They had some good stuff there, Jack in a Box. Okay. Jack in a Box were one of the first drive-thrus, I remember.
Oh, all right.
That stayed open like past 10. They'd stayed open till like 2 a.m. or something like that. I remember that.
Okay.
So maybe you, Frank, can bring me some Jack in a Box to Atlanta, too?
If you'd like. He's a pretty accommodating guy. I'm not sure how fresh it's going to be, but...
Sourdough burger was always very good.
Okay, I like a sourdough bread.
And they used to have these fried tacos there at Jack in a Box. They were really good.
Fried tacos.
Yeah.
Sounds like a health food item.
Yeah. Very good.
Right on.
Anyway, ask him for that.
I will. Okay, I'll ask him about the Jack in a Box. Okay, let's get to our guest here. He's our guest. I'm so glad to have this guy on the show. He's a Renaissance man. He has many facets to his life, to his creativity. He's a terrific bass player, songwriter, vocalist with New Orleans' own hard rock, stoner metal veteran Suplex, the great Suplex. He's also log time with I Hate God, very well-known New Orleans and just generally metal band. Also former owner of the Portside Lounge. Had a great run there, the Central City Tiki Bar and Mardi Gras Indian headquarters right there on Dryad Street. And he's also done a lot of work in the movie business, works with Scott Ploche on a lot of projects. We're going to get into all that and more. But without further ado, the great Mr. Danny Nick. Welcome, Danny.
Oh, thank you, guys. Well, for having me on the show. It's truly an honor.
Absolutely.
And what better place than Snake and Jake's?
Snake and Jake's. You were saying you had stories of being here as a youth.
Many. Yeah. I believe they opened in 1994.
That sounds about right.
And so I was part of the first. You know, I was going to school at Loyola, actually.
Okay.
And so I would always come here like at night after class, whatever, grab a beer. I'd usually come on nights like this. I'd also be here on the weekends, but a lot of times I'd come in here just on those quiet nights to grab that one beer or something.
Right.
And I was actually, there's the famous naked night that happened here. But two bartenders came in here back then. It was Elaine and Frank. And I guess they had the same birthday. And they came in here one night and declared if everybody got naked, they could drink. I was here that night, but I was here earlier that night drinking by myself. Had a beer. A couple of girls from Loyola came in that I kind of knew, kind of didn't know. Both real pretty girls. And, of course, it's like the typical story of my life. I got up and left and went home and then came back the next day, and the bartender told me the whole story. Oh, man, 10 minutes after you left, they came in, got naked. Everybody got naked, And I was like, did those girls? Oh, yeah, they were beautiful. And I was just like, really, man?
Well, Danny, I'm looking around the bar right now, and I'm glad everybody's keeping their clothes on.
Yeah, right. It's, definitely not the same crowd I remember 1994, but actually the same crowd. We're just all a little bit older, I guess,
okay,
right?
Well,
give maybe some...
Right on. Well, so let's go back a little bit. I know you are from New Orleans, correct?
Yes, born and raised.
And what part of town? Did y'all live in?
Metairie.
Okay.
Grew up in Metairie.
So where'd you wind up going to school, high school?
Brother Martin.
Okay, Brother Martin. Back in my old stomping grounds in Gentilly.
Oh, yeah. Chili Gentilly, yeah.
Right. You're younger than Kyle Malasson, huh? Kyle went to Brother Martin.
Yeah, but I know you're talking about.
I know a bunch,
I'm actually... My generation, he's 1 year older than me, but was Stanton Moore, actually.
Oh, okay.
Stanton,
right on.
Stanton, and that was, talk about set the bar pretty high, at a young age, with music, that is. We all grew up skateboarding, Metairie, skate punks,
Where were y'all skating in Metairie?
That's just it, you got to realize that back then, Pontchartrain Beach had closed down,
mm-hmm.
right? There really wasn't any kind of, outlet for kids that were between ages of 12 to 18, which was the drinking age back then. So things like skateboarding, you know, you just found places. I lived by the East Jefferson Hospital, so we used to go there and get chased out of there all the time. We just do it for fun, you know?
Just like skateboarding on the ramps or something?
Oh, just down the parking garage. Uh-huh. You know, this is back in the 80s, too. The tricks weren't what they are now. You know, we weren't doing all those kind of crazy tricks and stuff.
Right.
But there was a counterculture, you know, and it was also centered around punk rock music and stuff like that.
Is that how you first started getting involved in playing music?
Yeah, I guess it was, you know, my brother, you know, I had two older brothers that played music.
Your oldest brother, Rick Nick, played in RZA, and he's a little bit older than me.
He was in RZA, and, you know, I have early memories of that as, like, a small child, and, you know, they were you know, around really the punk movement, it began, you know, the early 70s, you know, version of the punk movement.
Right.
And so, my brothers are, I wasn't a planned child. My oldest brother's 15 years older than me. The next one is 13 years older than me. And I came around in the 70s.
But your parents were married at the time.
They were married
so
at the time.
So it was not unplanned.
And I do look like both of them.
So it was not unplanned.
Right.
So
right. It was just...
They had a house. They were married.
Yes.
Well, maybe it was just a surprise.
That was the surprise, yeah. Right. Yeah. And so...
I don't know if it was planned or
so
not.
So they were going... You know. They were going to punk shows when I was just still learning how to walk and stuff. But I have these vague memories of it and stuff. And, you know, it's weird because I grew up in a different generation, with a different generation of punk rock and with music and stuff. But I always kind of carried the stuff that my older brother, you know, taught me along the way. You know, he was into a lot of the 70s rock stuff. Uh-huh. So, you know, when I first got into punk rock, like Black Flag and that kind of stuff, I mean, it was three chord, you know, screaming stuff. As I've matured out of that era of my life, you know, I rediscovered more of the 70s stuff, you know. The obvious one being like maybe Black Sabbath or something like that.
Right.
But also like the Allman Brothers and, you know.
Like the Stooges. I hear a lot of Stooges in some of the stuff that y'all
do. Yes, a lot of, you know, and so it's got the kind of like, it's got kind of the aggression of punk rock, you know, but definitely like trying to get into more complicated chord structures than just three chord rock and roll.
Don't get
you know?
Too complicated.
You don't want to go over people's head, you know. But, you know, and if, like I said earlier, you know, Stanton Moore, he set the bar kind of high. So you could, you know, just our original little three chord punk rock band, you know, was horrible compared to what he was already doing, you know, right out the gate. So,
well, were y'all doing that when you were in high school? Were y'all starting to play?
We were like, I guess 15, 16, you know, I literally put down a skateboard and I picked up a guitar, actually, but Darrell, who is in my band to this day, you know, we still play music together. We were in our first band together, and he was a much better guitar player, you know. But both, like, his dad and my oldest brother, like, kind of, you know, passed down chord arrangements and stuff. So we did know a little bit more than, like, our friends, you know. We knew we knew blues, 12 bar blues stuff,
right,
and all. And like I said, we learned, they were forcing that stuff on us. We wanted to play Black Flag, and then later on, it's like, you know what? Let's dig into some of this stuff, you know. And that's kind of where Suplex, you know, kind of picked up more into getting into like chord start, you know, a lot of blues, you know, like heavy blues rock like stuff, you know.
Right. You know, and I hear that in your music for sure. It's like it doesn't have a math rock.
No.
Heavy metal element, like a lot of, you know, the Germanic kind of influence.
Right. A lot of
bands.
We dig into it a little bit, but we try to keep it more, you know, try to keep the New Orleans, you know, like, you know, believe it or not, the Meters are one of the biggest influences on us, you know. Even the other, that band I Hate God, I was saying this just the other day, and people, I know it just sounds crazy when I say it, but the lineup I got when I was in the band, which was in the late 90s, there was a drummer, Joey Lacaze, and he, one of his biggest influences was Zigaboo.
Yeah.
And he would play, you know, off the beat, because they play super slow, these guys, but the way he would play off the beat, you know, when you play super slow, you think it's easy. It's not. It's very hard. You got it. I mean, you hit it a half a second too late, the downbeat or whatever, everybody hears it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And when I joined the band, of course, I was like, these guys just play slow, you know? But then it was like, wow, you know? And
takes a lot of control. It takes a lot of,
I had to hear the way this guy pulled off the, like, this, he did this, like, back at the gack, girl.
Right.
And you had to follow that, you know? I was actually ran into Jimmy Bauer the other night from I Hate God, and I said, you know, if you took an I Hate God record and sped it up, some of the songs, you would actually have a meter song with a guy screaming, well, like a high-pitched girl screaming over it. But you could, you know, actually, I know it sounds crazy and people look at me like, no way, you know, but no, it's
no,
it's,
I get where you're coming from there. So you graduate from Brother Martin, I assume?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
it wouldn't make or break you.
Right.
I don't think it would have stood, you know, that high school diploma probably hasn't come into play too many times.
No. Mostly, where'd you go to high school? Because that's the big question in this town, right?
Notice I didn't say, where'd you graduate from high school?
Right. Nobody, that's true. Everybody just says, where'd you go to high school? You know, because a lot of us, you know.
But, so you went to college after that?
I went to Loyola. For communications.
Right on.
And graduated Loyola with 2 degrees, one in sociology and one in communications.
Wow, you may be too degreed to be on the Troubled Men podcast.
The irony of that is that I graduated Loyola and 1 year later joined I Hate God and went on tour and started, you know, with that band. Yeah, we actually had Suplex already. It's kind of a weird, you know, I joined that band almost on a fluke. They saw me play and they were
I Hate God.
Okay. They were at a show and their bass player was about to quit and they just saw me play and just said, you know, would you want to play? And I was familiar with the band, you know, growing up here and stuff, but I didn't like have their records or anything, you know. And so I was kind of like, really, you know, and these guys to me, you know, I always thought of them as guys that like just got out of jail or something, you know, like they had forearm tattoos way before, you know. So I was kind of like intimidated, like, oh, I meet them, you know. And I looked like I was like 13, you know, when I joined a band.
Right.
But I joined, and I mean, you know, it's funny, like my career kind of went backwards because I joined a band that, like, you know, they were touring, you know, selling out shows in New York. We had roadies on one of the.
They were a headlining act. Headlining, were you all like on tour buses or?
Tour bus. Yeah, well, I did a European tour. You know, on tour bus.
And how old were you? You're like in
23.
Okay.
You know, and we had like you know, we had roadies. Like, I didn't even have to set up my own stuff. Yeah. I just plug into the SVT. I didn't even own an SVT at the time. I ended up, you know, getting them, renting it or whatever, you know.
Right.
So, you know, like, yeah, I mean, I was like, and then my career just went backwards from there.
You got spoiled. It's like, oh, fuck it.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, Suplex, and we're driving our own van. We're loading big amps. Wait, why big amps? Why did we pick big amps, you know?
I don't know.
I mean, now at 50 years old, it's like, man, what was that? Thinking, you know?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't small amps like the cool thing, you know? Like the smallest possible thing to make the biggest, you know? But I mean,
you know,
we know
for
why.
Bass, it has to be a certain size.
Yes, but, as bass players, you know. It's a kind of a.
But it doesn't have to be an 8-10 cabinet.
It doesn't. I guess what we do, it's weird because I'm at that crossroads right now. I'm actually. You guys are familiar with Paul Webb and Bywater Music.
Sure. Yeah, I am for sure.
And so Paul's building me an amp right
now. He's terrific, man.
And he's doing one from scratch. He's doing a 400-watt high watt. Bass amp for me, and the thing is, it's you know, when I get it, it's going to be real physically heavy. And again, it's like, why am I? You know, part of me is like, why am I doing this? But I guess for me, it's like, I'm 50, you know, this is my midlife crisis.
Okay.
You know, some guys get a convertible or they get the hot rod car.
I Hate God still around?
They are. They are like, I think they were just in Mexico a couple of days ago, and they tour the world. They played New Zealand, and I quit right before they did all that.
Ties
in with why I left the bar too early that night. I quit the band too early, like a year later.
That means everything, man.
Yeah, and I'm just a little later, a little too early,
right.
A little later, something like that.
Well, that's what your girl said too.
Something like that, yeah.
So on those. Worldwide tours, that must have been incredible, huh?
It was
because they have the heavy metal, like country music, is big everywhere.
It is, and it's one of those things where, you know, going all the way back to Louis Armstrong, like there's genres of music, like in New Orleans, we're all just, hey, what's up, you know? But then, like, you know, you guys go play, you know, and you're famous, you're well known, you know, bass player, and in New Orleans, we're just 3 jerk-offs in the corner,
nobody cares.
Right, you know, and you can tell somebody you did something cool, like played a sold-out show, and they still don't care, you know, and it's just, that's new, and that's awesome. That's kind of what makes New Orleans, New Orleans,
exactly.
You know? But you know, so I joined this band, and I knew they were big, but I had no idea, and, you know, I went from playing, like, they saw me, I auditioned for that gig, playing like a Friday night at Checkpoint Charlie's, you know, to like a mid-sized crowd, you know,
which not is a like soul. 30 people.
Yeah, you put 30 people in there, it looks packed. That's right. What was great about it, you know? Uh-huh. So, I mean, I went from playing that, you know, and literally like 3 weeks after they asked me, which was 3 weeks after that show, you know, playing New York, sold out, a place called the Coney Island High.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, sold out. Their headline. And, you know, I've learned all the songs, you know, they weren't hard to learn, but it was all about getting that rhythm with that drummer.
Right.
Once I got that, then it all kind of fell into play. And, you know, it isn't the hardest chord structures, but it's still fun.
But you got to play with a band.
It was a lot of fun. You know, they tune in C. That was crazy. I never did any sort of alternate tuning either.
You know, so how would you turn the bass? How would you tune
it? Everything would be like
you were tuned down two whole steps.
Yeah, well, two whole steps, I guess.
Two,
right?
Two, yeah, whole,
two
steps.
Whole steps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everything's to every string.
Holy fuck, man! What kind of strings did you have?
Very
to use
heavy gauge strings
to keep that thing heavy, flapping around.
Yeah, because that's the thing. And I had to learn all of that on the fly. You know, like you got to get like heavier gauge strings so because it'll easily just fly out of tune.
Yeah,
you know? So yeah, actually, Suplex, we tune in D. We don't, you know, so we're right in the middle.
Right. What's our guitar player Rod Hodges always tunes a whole step down.
Just really?
Standard
okay.
Tuning, but his lowest note is a D.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what we do. And it's funny because you just try to tell some people like, you know, laugh at me for that or whatever. But it's that's how I've been playing for like the last 25, 30
years. It's a sound,
30,
man.
You know.
Okay, now that makes a lot of sense because I was listening to y'all's record today and I was like, that is so sludgy, man.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's funny, the sludge, you know, sludge term. When I, at Portside, I don't know if you, towards the end, you know, we had Russell Batiste.
Right.
Used to come in, and I let him do Tuesday nights, and it was basically, for me, it was like church. So he'd be doing just rehearsals. We'd open at 5, but it was open to anybody, so could come hang out, you know, for rehearsals. Sometimes it would be packed. Sometimes you'd have, you know, people like Samantha Fish, you know, hanging out there and stuff. And sometimes it would be empty. It would be just me and the band, you know, watching them play. And but when I first met him, I was introduced to him to this guy, Kevin Scott. I don't know if you know Kevin Scott. He's the bass player for Government Mule. He plays with Government Mule now.
Right, right, yeah.
But he was just, growing up, he was a Suplex fan. You know, that's how we met. And so nice. So he kind of came to my bar one night and said, oh, man, you're Danny Nick from Suplex. And then you know, he knew he wanted to throw a party there, and he had Russell Batiste show up, and he introduced me. And so he goes, yeah, you know, it's my friend Danny. He plays in a heavy rock band. And the first thing Russell Batiste says to me, he goes, you ever heard of the Slugs? And I was like, yeah, I know the Slugs. Now, just to give you a quick recap on who the Slugs are, the Slugs is the band that's now known as Crowbar, which is another world, you know. This guy, Kurt Winstein's got his own signature line of guitars.
Right.
But they're from New Orleans, and they were the first guys to do that slow, like even before I Hate God. I mean, one of the guys was in I Hate God, but like the slow, heavy thing. And I was looking at Russell, you know, here I am with Russell Batiste. You know, we cover Sissy Strut, Suplex. Uh-huh. I'm thinking I'm going to talk to him about how many times I played Sissy Strut. I might have played Sissy Strut more times than he did because we used to tour it, you know, play it. I mean, you know, we could argue it, you know. And that's not what we're talking about. He's talking about heavy, slow music. He said, man, I used to go up in the Green Warehouse in Mid-City with the ramp that goes up in it.
Yeah, Jimmy Robinson's place.
Yeah, yeah. And he'd go sit in his room, and I guess I could say this now that he passed away, but he'd sit there, but man, I'd be all high on crack, you know, and waiting for the meters to show up, the rest of the meter, funky meters to show up for rehearsal, and those dudes would be across the hall, and he would be tripping out on it, you know?
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe, I was like, man, I can't believe we're talking, you know, kind of what I'm telling you about the I Hate God sounds like the meter, you know, it all, you know, and I was like, this is the conversation I'm going to have, you know? But anyway, I miss him, you know, and he was such a character, a soul.
Oh, wow, we have a package we're being delivered
to
the that's not the Bosco. God. I know it's not, it's because it's not the right shape, but
it's very heavy.
But man, maybe we'll have to get to open that on the break and we'll reveal it to
Jesus. I don't know if you want to. I don't know. I guess we're bombable.
We'll see. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, sir.
See, it might be a pager in here, a bunch of pagers.
Yeah, man, we'll page each other.
No, I'm cool. I'm on the right side.
Flowood, Mississippi.
Okay. Well, we'll have to see what that is.
That's Flowood, Mississippi.
See, right in the middle of a conversation, we're getting packages.
Oh, God.
Danny, see what we're doing over here, man?
Hey, man. This is a
it's a whole thing.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, maybe this is a good time to take a little break.
Sure. Yeah.
So,
we'll get into all the rest of your career. but Manny, tell the people.
Oh, yeah. So what we do is we take a break. I don't know if you've ever listened to this show.
Yes.
We're going to take a break. We're going to use the restroom if you need to, and the troubled nation will go get libations and whatever they have to do, but we'll be right back.
Back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Coleman, back with our guest, Mr. Danny Nick. Now, Danny, I know as a sometimes listener to the show, you're familiar that we are operating as a listener-supported operation. And before we started referring to it as that, we would talk about our original sponsor, which was what, Manny?
Loose change.
We haven't mentioned that that phrase in a while.
Right.
Kind of moved on from it. We're doing that bit for a little bit, but again, we are in the heart of the Klempire here at Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge, and periodically, devoted listeners, will send us correspondence here, and sometimes there'll be some favors, sometimes some artwork they made themselves with their own hands, like a little flip book or something, or a little fanzine sort of deal, and sometimes cash in an envelope. Well, as you may recall from right before the break, we were delivered a big, heavy package. It's also kind of greasy. I'm still not sure why it was a little bit greasy. But
Well, look where you are, man.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I was wondering if you guys had any enemies or something.
It did go well. We do. For sure we do. But they know where we are. Show up.
Right. Yeah, bring it.
Yeah, you know where the fuck we are. We dare you. Anyway, so I assumed that this was something, friendly, fan mail from some flounder.
Very small package, only like a 3x5 box.
But very heavy.
But very, very heavy.
And well sealed.
Well sealed.
I had to go to my car and get a razor blade knife and cut it open.
Got a box cutter, yeah.
Got a box cutter. And we open it up.
And we open it up.
And it's loose change. It's like a 5-pound, 10-pound bag of loose change in a Ziploc bag. It's nickels, pennies.
I say
quarters.
We go to Caesar's right now.
Go to Caesar's? Put it all in black?
Double your money. You'll have $20.
Yeah, there you go.
And it says Troubled Men written on the outside of the Ziploc bag. And then on the inside, it's a note from our listener, longtime listener and supporter, Eddie Voynich, says, "Here's your loose change. Hope all is well." Eddie V.
Thank you, Eddie.
Shout out to Eddie Voynich.
Yeah,
we love you, man.
Very
we love
nice
the,
guy.
Not only the supporting the podcast, which we do appreciate, but the panache with which you do that. You
know, the attitude.
The flair. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also should thank Jim Crissy, who jumped in, a first-time supporter of the podcast. Apparently, he was on a flight to South Africa, and he said, "Thank God I downloaded a bunch of episodes of the Troubled Men podcast for my 16-hour flight to Cape Town."
Oh, God.
I was like,
Jesus.
Yeah, good luck with that, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
But So yeah, shout
what
out.
Airline goes is
I don't know. Maybe he said I'd have to look back in the, in his little note.
Spirit.
I don't think he did. Spirit. Yeah.
No.
That would be rough.
That would be a rough flight.
Shout out to Jim Crissy. Yeah. And like Eddie Voynich and Jim Crissy, you can support the podcast if you're listening to it. You must be enjoying it. Otherwise, please turn it off. If you're listening to it, please support the podcast. We have the Venmo link and the PayPal link and the show notes of every show, as well as the pinned Facebook page. And also, we'd suggest that you, if you don't want the week-to-week hassle of have I supported the podcast, have I not, you could join our Patreon page, and it makes it automatic. You know, you're there week in, week out supporting us. We have a handful of people that are there, and we love our patrons. Thank you so much for sticking with us. And also, again, every week we get closer and closer to gift-giving season. And we have the Troubled Men Podcast t-shirts, which are available, and tank tops.
Nice.
And so, you know, clothe your whole family in them if you wish. Also, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook. Also, subscribe, rate, and review to the podcast wherever you listen to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps us a lot. Costs you nothing. I always feel like I'm leaving something out here, but I'll be all around the road with a bunch of different bands. You can find those dates on my Renee Coman Facebook page or iguanas.com, and I think that's definitely enough of that. So back to our guest, Mr. Danny Nick. So Danny, you're out with I Hate God. You come back to the stark reality of a independent New Orleans heavy band,
right?
But then you get some recognition. You get a record deal. Somebody sees you, and you actually your first independently released record gets re-released. Correct?
Yes.
And
that's Suplex.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. We you know it the affiliation with I Hate God obviously didn't hurt. Mm-hmm. But we were able, you know, and Suplex was, you know, my main baby, you know, I mean,
right.
And Darrell and I, you know, we nurtured that, you know, for many years. And so, yeah, we were able to push ourselves forward, and we got a record deal through a label called Man's Ruin Records. It was out of San Francisco.
That was
in
a good
90s.
Label, right? That
had yeah, they a lot of like, Queens of the Stone Age, they put their first album out on that. The Melvins had put some releases out on that. Fu Manchu. So we were in a really cool, you know, group of people, you know, and it was just a perfect time, you know, and it
this
led
is,
to
this is like early 2000s,
yeah, early the first album came out in 2000, so we recorded it and stuff in the 90s, but you know, we hit the road, you know, we actually had a local girl from here, Deborah Toscano. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
I don't know her.
Local girls, but she had a booking, she started her own booking agent called Devil Doll Productions.
Okay.
And she was our booking agent, booked us, you know, coast to coast. You know, we probably did coast to coast like 6 times or so.
So you're out there, 3 guys in a van. You had a crew member, or just
we bring a fourth person with us, you know, just to do merch and help load with the loading of the big amps that we chose to play.
Right,
you know,
right.
But we did it. We had a you know, we never did get a trailer. Never ever. You know, we had a short van the first time, and we had, you know, all the stuff stacked in the back. We had like a loft across the top, so. You know, back then, you know, sometimes you'd sleep in a van and rest areas, you know, and so like 2 of us would get it in the loft, you know, and I'd always be in a window because I'm kind of claustrophobic, and then Darrell would always get the seat, you know, and I think we just did that as a 3-piece, but you know, without a fourth person, you know, on some of those early tours, but you know, then but you know, we got to get the Motel 6s and stuff like that,
sure.
and
your way up,
yeah, you know, like first it's like everybody in one Motel 6, a couple of us would do the floor, and then the next night the other 2 dudes would do the floor,
right.
You know, and that's so disgusting when you think about it now too.
Yeah, Motel 6, yeah,
yeah.
For sure.
So wait, going back to I Hate God,
yes.
Now, did you going on world tours, you know, nationwide, get any kind of protest to the name of the band?
Like Christians, you mean?
Yeah, you know, were there Christians and religious groups?
No, I think that happened when they first formed. I didn't ever deal with any of that, you know, personally. There was never any, you know, you know, it's funny because you remember like in the 80s, that was a big thing, like the Satanism, you know, like, right. I remember even Bill Elder, the local guy, did like a special on Satanism, you know, and I would love to watch that now because I'm like, how hokey.
Satanic panic, they call it.
Yeah, right. You know, and I love to watch that now because like, how hokey. You know, it's like, say, man, the Easter Bunny's out there, you know, like, come on, man, you know. But, you know, what's really crappy about it, that's when I went to Brother Martin, you know, like I was watching those specials with my mom and dad, and on the show, you know, on the Bill Elder show, you're like, look for, you know, signs, you know, like, you know, crosses and, you know, band names like Metallica and Slayer. And I'm sitting there like, oh no, you know, like those, both of those. Like, I was drawing Metallica logos, you know, I mean, you know, Slayer, who I still think is an awesome band, you know, so yeah, you know, I was right. That was the target generation for that, you know, but no, I got, you know, the name was accepted. Now, you know, I come from a Sicilian, Roman Catholic family.
Are you, the Knicks are Sicilian?
Yeah. My dad's, not my dad's side, but my mama's side
was. Okay, right.
And the last name from my mama's side would have been Pizzatolo, was the name that came over from Sicily. Yeah.
That's a good Sicilian name.
Not easy to, not too hard to confuse that as being
double Z.
Right.
Now, what is Nick?
Nick is Irish, it's German French, actually, like from that region that France and Germany share. I don't know. I always, whatever that region is, but
Champagne region,
something like that.
No,
you know.
I know what it is.
Anyway, you didn't get any kickback from I Hate God. I mean, nothing. Nobody really protested.
No, they, you know,
because pretty much everyone hates God.
I mean,
God has been a big disappointment to
you
everybody.
You know, right? You know, it's
speak for yourself.
And yeah, I had to lie to my mom. You know, I told her I played in at the other band, Crowbar, because we toured with them a lot. So I lied and told her I was in Crowbar. I didn't want her to know I played tonight. But then of course, my brother Dave, you know, went and told her the truth, which didn't help anybody. So I, you know, still thank him for that. But yeah, you know, it was that was a, you know, crazy time. I got to tour Europe with those guys, and like I said, I was on a tour bus, and it kind of maybe goes with playing in a band like that. There's
All
always
Saints
some
Lorraine. That's
all. That's it. That's, All Saints
that's,
Lorraine. That's
the
exact,
German area.
All
of France.
Saints Lorraine.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thank you.
But you know, there is like a bad mojo that follows a name like that, and like you know, this story. Every member of the band's had some kind of tragedy. You know, just different weird things that happen in their life when they're in the band. Mine was, I was on tour with those guys in Germany. Kind of a crazy story. We went to some guy's house. We may or may not have been looking for weed.
Sure.
And we were hanging out, and the guy had a dog, and I was like, oh, look, you know, and I'm a super dog lover, and I'm sitting here, and I bend over to pet the dog, and the dog growls at me, and that should have been it. But it wasn't. I was like, no, I'm going to win this dog over. And so I went in for a second when the dog bit a piece of my lip off my face.
Oh, jeez.
Wow. Like, I mean, like a horror scene. Like, blood got all over the two guys in my band. They put me in a bathroom. They're putting pressure on my face. A piece of my lip was retrieved, sewed back on my face in the hospital. Like, it was a professional hospital, but it was weird. It was like a doctor's chair. I spent 3 days in a hospital and then flew home. Left the tour, you know, I mean, I couldn't get back.
Man.
Tour bus. I mean, you know, the bands, it's like Crowbar, Soylent Green, and I Hate God, you know, and of course they have, you know, bathrooms on those tour bus, but that's just a traveling, like, portalette.
Petri dish. Yeah,
that is a traveling portalette. I mean, especially with these, you know, middle of the night, man, any random member of any of these metal bands, I mean, God bless them, I love them all, you know, but you know, you're hitting over the walls. People are passing out.
You're saying
you
wouldn't want to have an open wound in that environment.
No. Definitely, like a. And what was weird is the way it played out. Like, I was in a hospital. The tour went on without me. You know, they had two guitars, so one of them, but my bass stayed in Europe with the band while I went home. And it's kind of a, my baby, but it came home, you know.
Okay. Kind of like my Bosco.
Yes, it is. It's on its own journey, just like your Bosco.
Exactly.
Like, you get reunited with it, you know. And
so let me ask, going back to I Hate God.
Okay.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So you're playing these shows. Now, do you have like an announcer go, ladies and gentlemen, I Hate God, and then you go out and play, or you just go out and play?
It's funny you say that. The very first show I played with him was a festival You know, just like I led up to this, right? Here I was, Checkpoint Charlie's, 3 weeks later, my first show, learned all the songs. It's a metal festival in Chicago. Big stage, big like state palace size, like theater right. stage. I don't think we're the headliner, but we're way up on the bill, you know, right. a bunch of metal bands. And who's the announcer who did that? Ron Jeremy.
Oh. Ron Jeremy, wow.
And, you know, as we come on stage, he's standing there shaking our hands. And it's just, I mean, immediately, like, I don't want to shake this guy's hand, you know? I mean, I've seen that guy's hand doing, horrible
you
things.
You didn't even have an open wound yet.
I didn't even have it. Yeah. You're right, you know. It's, you know, you didn't try to kiss me on my lips either, you know. But still, it was just like, man, like, what, you know.
So he said, ladies and gentlemen, I hate God.
Yeah,
was he naked with an erection when he said it?
Thank God he wasn't.
Because I met Ron Jeremy. I'm from Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had a rainbow room.
Yeah,
you know.
I met him a couple times at Bordner's, which is a great bar off of Hollywood Boulevard. Bordner's and the home of the Bucket. A drink called the Bucket.
Oh, right
which
on.
Which is basically your favorite drink, but it's pretty much in a glass that's way too big to finish. They call it the Bucket.
Okay.
But I met him there, and he seemed like a nice guy now, but he's in jail now.
He's dying. He's got dementia or something, so he doesn't even remember all of the 1,000 women he's slept with, you know.
He didn't remember them anyway.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but
that's a feather in your cap.
That's
a good story.
You know,
a lot of people come on here and they have. I go, oh, you must have had a lot of crazy things happen. They go, yeah, a lot of crazy things. I can't name any of them.
Oh man, this could be a 4-hour podcast.
Right. Well, no. we'll see what comes up organically here. But so you come back off the I Hate God tour. You're back. You're out touring around. Nationally on Man's Ruin records with Suplex, your baby, your main band with your guy. So you've known Darrell since you're in high school, right?
Yeah, we go back to, I mean, we met in like 1988, maybe 87, 88, you know.
Which you were like 10 or something.
Now, what's the name of your third member?
Andy Preen.
Okay.
Andrew Preen.
He's the drummer, yeah.
Yes, and he's the drummer. Drummer extraordinaire.
Outstanding. And it's such a cool band because it has the sludge element, it has the heavy blues element, but then the drummer will still play a lot of that like blast kind of double bass drum stuff, you know.
It's a single pedal. He just
feathers it like that, like John Bonham.
Yeah.
Like, people hear Bonham, they're like, oh, you need a double bass pedal. No, you don't.
No. He can just, you know, compensate. He comes from a real musical family. His dad was a big band leader, a jazz band leader at Delgado.
Oh, okay.
For a number of years. And so he grew up playing,
swing
and all that stuff.
Right.
So he knows all that jazz stuff, and he can do all those kind of, you know, fills and crazy stuff.
But he digs heavy music.
But he digs, right, but he loves, Van Halen was like the band that, like, you know, apparently, I didn't notice, but Alex Van Halen, well, the Van Halen brothers were jazz studied musicians. You know, Eddie Van Halen and Alex, the drummer. I'd only noticed because Andy told me this. So, and he says if you listen to it, Alex Van Halen's drumming style, you can hear jazz in it. You know, again,
Well, you know, a lot of guys that came up then, like in the late 60s, early 70s,
right.
They were either listening to or studying from guys who were coming out of like the Gene Krupa.
Yeah, exactly. You're right.
Scene, really.
Right. I mean, it's you know, like Jimi Hendrix and Experience. You know, is it Noel Redding was the bass player? You know, bass player in the Experience.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I love his, you know, just the bass line, that simplicity of a three piece. You know, and just where, like, you know, Jimmy's doing his thing, but like he's just holding all of the other, you know, all the other, you know, with the low end, and some of it's kind of just simple, but it's just perfect. You know, and it's not over. You know, it's not, you know, over the top,
overly notey. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
you know, it does its job. You know, and as a bass player, I try to find that, like, you know, do my job. I'm not a slap bass player or, you know, or in the metal scene, one of these, you know, just crazy,
super notey guys. Yeah.
No.
You know, as a bass player, I think you and I see myself as like the engineer on a submarine. and right. I'm walking around in the engine room with pants rolled up to my knees, right. walking in water.
Yeah.
I'm just making sure that all the engines are cool, everything is lubricated,
right.
it's all driving full speed ahead.
You're in the bass sort of rhythm, you know, but then you're also got accompanied with melodies that are going on, and you're kind of right up in the middle. You know, you're dealing with the melodies and accommodating that, but you're also holding down the groove, you know, and I like it like that, you know.
That's where I want to be. Yeah. I don't need to be doing anything more than that. No, that's plenty.
That's right. It's my comfort zone, you know.
Me too. Right on, Danny. So when I first met you, there was this bar. It was like a Mardi Gras Indian headquarters in the hood on Dryads, not on the Dryads Boulevard, not on Aretha Castle Haley, the big open boulevard with a median.
No,
with
the
a
neighborhood.
Neutral ground. Now, in the neighborhood, like a couple blocks from Jackson Avenue or something.
Yeah.
Now, what possessed you to open the Portside Lounge?
Well, you know, at the time I was married and I was working in the film industry, and it was around 2015 when Bobby Jindal changed the tax incentives for movies.
And killed
a lot of it. We went from feature films to like NCIS was like the one job in town. And I can't work on NCIS, and that could be a whole other story. But anyway, so, you know, I was stuck between a rock and a hard place. There was really nothing else going on. And my wife at the time and I, we went out with a couple one night to Latitude 29, and we were in there. And, you know, I always kind of, I guess, like, I like tiki inadvertently. I didn't realize I liked tiki, you know. Mm-hmm. Working on movies, I deal with a lot of set dressing and stuff like this, like Snake and Jake's. I've always loved this bar because of the weird ambiance, the darkness, you know, the kind of coziness of it, where you can just kind of hide in a corner kind of thing. We went to Latitude 29 one night with this couple, and the couple was freaking out because Beach Bum Berry, the owner, was there, and I had no idea who he was. And I'm just like, man, it seemed to be this guy. They treat him like a rock star, you know. Uh-huh. And so I'm, you know, curious about it, and my now ex-wife and I, we kind of researched after we went there that night, and you know, it turns out he's this famous, you know, cocktail guru.
Okay.
And she bought me one of his books, Tales of the Cocktail, and I read it, and I was converted. I mean,
really?
This book is a great book, man. It's got all these old cocktail recipes in it, the history of tiki, not just the history of tiki, but the history of, like, colonization of the Caribbean, for good and bad, you know? Just all through the ages, you know, from the earliest of times of, you know, with natives were drinking, you know, to, like, the British coming over with rum. You know, like, for instance, the daiquiri was invented during the Spanish-American War. Troops landed on the shores of Cuba on, like, a sugar plantation, and the owner of the plantation, you know, wanted to have something to greet these guys because they were helping with the revolution, and he had limes, and he had sugar, and he had rum. And so that's the holy trinity of all tiki drinks, and then boom. And guess what the name of the town was? Daiquiri.
Wow.
And so, you know, and it's
stories. It was a gay community, the daiquiri?
Yeah, and it was. So, you know, and just like that. And of course, you know, growing up in New Orleans, well, we know daiquiri is something else, right? We know this horrific, you know, well, I wouldn't say horrific. It just depends, you know. But, you
tell
know,
you what, my cousins from North Carolina. That's all they want to talk about is the drive-through daiquiris in New Orleans.
The frozen thing, right.
It's the best ever. They think it's...
And, you know, like, you know, it could be a guilty pleasure sometimes, you know. I mean, you drive-through daiquiris and all stuff. But, you know, so it all really fascinated me. I read his book, and then I got to give her credit. She was the one who kind of pushed, like, let's do this. Let's open a bar. I would have talked about opening a bar, just never done it, you know.
Sure. I would have been safer, but...
Yeah, right. And so she kind of... And then we, you know, we finally found a spot, you know, which was the spot on Dryads. There was a group of people that owned it. Dave Catching, who was in Queens of the Stone Age, was one of the...
Dave Catching is in the notes, I was thinking.
Yeah.
Because you must know Dave
Catching. Yeah, oh, yeah. And so Dave... You know, here I am with this tiki bar idea in a spot that was a barbecue joint in the hood in Central City, you know, that predominantly was, you know, an African-American bar, you know, for so many years. And also, you know, one of the home bases of where bounce music started in there, you know, this group UNLV started there, Juvenile, you know, all the Cash Money, all those guys came through that place.
Oh,
there was
right
a DJ
on.
And they all cut their teeth in that place.
Nice.
But no, of course there's no plaque on the building for that or anything. But when we went to the location, you know, I mean, I knew, you know, when we first went to go check it out, I mean, I knew where I was, you know, but when I walked in there, I saw on the wall, you know, Home of the Wild Red Flames, Mardi Gras Indian Tribe. Oh. And immediately I was like, this could be, you know, this is a crossroads of culture.
It is.
Because, you know, look, I'm a white kid from New Orleans, you know, make no mistake, or, you know, or Sicilian, whatever you want to say, sure. You know, or Sean, what is it, the Saints Lorraine or whatever, you know, region. Right. But nonetheless, you know, I'm seventh generation. I'm from here. You know, my mom grew up in the projects. But, you know, Mardi Gras, you know, it's almost like it's our birthright to kind of preserve these cultures.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and who can do it? You know, it needs to be exposed to something other than just the neighborhood, too, you know.
Okay.
Because in a neighborhood, it's awesome. I mean, it's their own, you know, thing. But, you know, I just tried to make it my goal to, like, you know, tell more people about the Mardi Gras Indians. And people, friends of mine, rock and roll friends of mine, that would come through town and, man, you got to check this out. And you want to know where the roots of all American music comes from? It comes from the beats that were done in Congo Square.
Right.
And that these guys, you know,
they still play.
Or the bearers of it, the culture bearers, you know. So it was really like, you know, I remember, you know, the neighborhood and even, you know, kind of, and I, you know, told my wife, you know, I said, man, you know, this is the spot. We're going to do this. And at first, she was against doing live music. And, you know, of course, it was kind of like an oxymoron. I'm like, you know, I know tons of musicians, you know, like, we got to do live music. Well, we'll see, you know. And so, of course, we did a soft opening with just, you know, cocktails. And we had too many cocktails. To be honest, we had if I could do it all over again, like, you start with like four cocktails, right, that you do really good. We had like 14 cocktails that we did, you know, varying. It's hard to keep track of all the different bartenders doing them all differently. And,
right,
you know,
right.
So, but then we did a grand opening and we got the band, the Unnaturals. The surf rock band, the Unnaturals, to play, and we like tripled the money that we made on any other night, and she was like, okay, and so that began Portside, you know, as a music venue.
Man, and it was a great room. I played there with every band that I play with.
Yeah,
even like
I know that's where we got to know each other really good.
That's where we.
So what happened?
Well,
it was so how come it's
you know
there?
we had you know, so I went through the divorce. And so, you know,
she took everything.
No, she abandoned it. You know, she didn't want anything to do with it, and I took it over. But then, then I immediately went through COVID.
Yeah, we had lockdown for 2 years.
Yeah, and so, and then I had COVID, and then coming out of COVID, you know, I actually had a lot of momentum after that. And, I finally did get broken into, like, it was probably just a few months before I ended up closing the doors. I also, I had damage from Hurricane Ida. I had some issues. I probably stuff I don't really want to talk about on the show.
No, it just,
I don't want to throw anybody. But
became too much. To deal with
so many different angles.
The joy had gone.
So many different angles. It was like, you know, canceling all the boxes on, like, nobody had my back, and this was not going to be successful. I mean, there were people that had my back and stuff like that, but it just started. I just looked at this like, this is this can't happen anymore. I can't do it anymore. Building had some serious issues with it. And, you know, of course, dealing with the city of New Orleans.
Picnic. Oh, yeah.
That is, you know, I don't wish that on my worst enemy, you know, having to go through some of the things I had to go through.
I'll bet.
You know, like, you want to open a business in New Orleans, it's like they're laughing at you, like, I dare you to.
Right,
you know,
right.
And it doesn't make sense because, you know, like, what happens when you chase all these local people from wanting to keep the cultures of, you know, whether it's, we're talking about Indian culture, just other cultures around the city together, or these old institutions,
mm-hmm.
and they're just closing, you know, I mean, just on my drive here, you know, you see all these places closing down, and it's like, so what replaces it? Chain restaurants?
Yeah. Houston.
Is that what, you know, like, you know, and it was.
Jack in a Box.
Jack in a Box.
Yeah.
This will be the furthest one east.
They were supposed to open.
Boy, I'd like to see
now New Orleans has the furthest one east.
I'd like to see them open a Jack in a Box on Dryads, man. I think it'd probably actually do a good business there.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Now, I remember when I first saw the location of the place before I'd ever been there, I was like, wow, that's deep in the hood.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Now, I know that area well, but so I knew without even going there.
It was Joe's House of Blues. Speaking of Houses of Blues,
okay.
It was one time.
Call it Crack in the Box.
Crack in the Box. So I drove there. I'm like, oh, this is a totally calm neighborhood. There was nobody. There wasn't any kind of open air drug market or anything.
No, it used to be one time.
Sure, everywhere used to be. I mean, the 90s were crazy,
right?
But it was like you could park there. You didn't feel unsafe.
I never had gunplay. There was no murder in front of the place the entire 5 years I had it. I never owned a gun. I bluffed like I had a gun several times.
Yeah.
But I never did own a gun. I still don't really know how to shoot a gun, or, you know, I'm not a gun person.
I am.
A lot of people thought I was crazy, you know, and it's like, man, you should go take a course. But I don't know.
You don't want to have to start pointing a gun at somebody. It's not the old West now.
Right. And that's what it would turn into. You know, I mean, and look, we had our own. I mean, the thing is, you got to stand your ground. You know, I couldn't be pushed around in a neighborhood. So, you know, I mean, I'm no Chuck Norris, but, you know, I'm more like an Alan Norris. But
I don't know who that is, but okay.
Well, Chuck Norris, you know, Chuck Norris. I made up Alan Norris. It's like, I'm more like his cousin that can't fight, you know. Right.
But I did notice going there, and like I said, I played there with every band. Like I play with the New Orleans. We even did several Pat McLaughlin gigs there.
Yeah,
Pat would come out.
Oh, Carlo Nucio said that about God rest his soul.
Yeah, he comes up on this podcast.
He owed you money too?
No.
He owed Manny $80.
No, he got me in free to see the Circle Jerks because he was friends with the Circle Jerks.
Yeah,
and
that
he managed.
That was right before he passed.
Yeah, that was. My brother Rick brought him to the show that night. And
was that Tepitina?
Yeah, and the Circle Jerks. Yeah, that's a band from, that's one of those bands from the 80s.
Manny's friends with the bass player.
Really?
I used to be friends.
Wow. Oh, man. I love the Circle Jerks.
Xander Slott.
I don't know why they didn't come up early.
You have I Hate God play at your gig, at your place?
You know, it wasn't going to happen eventually. It just never did get around to it. I had a lot of other, like, I had a band like Goat Whore. I had other, you know, big bands, and, you know. Yeah. But we just never got around to it. I mean,
look, it took us years to have Danny on the show. We had the
it's like everything in New Orleans
when he still had Portside open.
We talked about it. That's right. I remember. I was like, yeah, I'd love to do that. We'll just wait. Let me close the bar down and.
Let's see.
Go through COVID.
International pandemic.
Right. Let's.
We'll get.
You know what? Yeah. Let me. I'm gonna get the divorce out of the way. You know.
Right. Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we got to clear the books.
Yeah.
During the time that you had the place, I was playing there with somebody, and you were running the door or you were handling the guest list, and I said, oh, I have one guest, and you said, who's that? And I just tell me his name, I'll remember it. And I said, oh, it's this guy, looks just like me, except he's taller. Sounds just like me, Scott Peloche. Yeah, and you said, oh, I know Scott Peloche. I was like, how do you know Scott Peloche? You said, I worked for him in the movie business.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, that's the thing is, like, I guess kind of almost, if we go back a little bit, you know, when I was right at the same time that Suplex was doing a lot of big tours, like, we were starting to open for this band Clutch, and we were getting, you know, Clutch, you know, they play houses of blues and they play theaters and stuff, and they're, you know, Agora Theater in Cleveland, Ohio, and stuff like that. And we were getting the direct support gigs for that. At the same time, I started, you know, when I was in town, I was started set dressing on movies. And because at the time the amount of people that were working on movies and the amount of movies we were getting here up until the 2000s were, it was just a handful of people that really did it. Scott Ploche is one of those people who comes from that old school. I think Scott and his sister, I believe.
Yes.
Also,
yeah,
I haven't seen her.
Adele Ploche. Adele. Yeah.
And they were from that old school, older
in LA,
generation.
Yeah.
Before me, you know, before my time. And I came up, you know, here I was, this kid with tattoos and stuff, you know, and the older guys gave me a hard time, but then they all fell in love with me, you know, and it was a small, kind of closer knit community. But, I'd moved up. It was weird. I was juggling being a lead man, which is I was running a crew of set dressers, and sometimes turning those jobs down to go back on tour with bands like Clutch, you know, because that was my dream. It made less money, but it just made sense at the time.
I gotta go back in the van,
right?
Man.
Yeah, man. And of course, you know, some of these people look at me like I was nuts. Like, really, you're gonna go do that? And I was like, yeah, man. You know,
how fun it is.
Yeah, I'm still in my 20s. You know, like I'm like, oh, yeah, wow, I'm pushing 30. Or I guess I'm closer to 30 at that point. You know, so I'm like, yeah, man. It was, you know, it's weird. You know, it's these life decisions. And of course, I probably made the wrong one. But you know, Scott
seems to have worked out.
But Scott, you know, was he was one of those older guys. There was one job in particular we worked on, and he was an art director on it, and I was a lead man, and I was in over my head. It was like the biggest job I ever led. It was like it was one of those Final Destination movies, if you remember those. And he was the art director, and we both had a boss, the designer, who was just this crazy neurotic asshole. He's dead now, so it doesn't matter.
We don't have to mention his name.
But he was an asshole. You know, assholes die too. And so he was just crazy. You know, and it was, you know, Scott can hold his, you know, Scott is cool as a cucumber in a bowl of hot sauce. You know, like he can hold it together. Me, I'm Sicilian. You know, I'm not ready to fight the guy.
The blood
you know.
Is hot, right,
yeah.
man?
Yeah, man. I'm like trying not to, you know, and he talked me off the ledge a couple of times where like I almost, you know, and he gave me his own stories, you know, about like, man, you know, like there's been times, you know, where you know you just got to walk off and it was almost like for me there were some people I think were hoping like, yeah, the tattooed guy's gonna lose his shit,
wow, okay.
you know, like kind of baiting me like you know right. like let's right. see how you know like you know to see if I you know of course he's gonna look at him. He's covering. He's in over his head anyway. He shouldn't be here. You know, he should be in a band with his little rock and roll band.
Right, right,
you know,
right,
he shouldn't.
Right.
This
well,
is
you know,
big,
the movie
big boys.
Business is dead down here.
It is. Yeah, I know. It's
and you know why? Because of AI.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. Hollywood does it. They're still. I mean, it's not just dead here in New Orleans.
No,
but
all in the whole country.
It's a crisis.
Dead.
It is.
Yeah.
You know.
No one's working.
I know. It's
because of the AI. The studios don't have to figure. They're trying to figure out what they're going to do.
I mean, look. I closed the bar down and I figured, you know, man, I can go back to working on the movies, especially uh-huh. like when COVID ended. There was this big influx of movies. I said, this is great. You know, it's probably a good time to get back in. I actually, you know, can work towards a pension. You know, I got like another 8 years before I'm eligible for like a pension. From it,
oh, okay.
So man, you know, it's good time.
IOTC.
Yeah, IOTC, okay. right? And so it's a good time to get back into it. I've worked like you know.
The only movies that can still make money are pornos.
Yeah,
you can still do pornos.
There you go. You know.
Now I used to do boom work for porno films.
I know some guys who some Teamsters that were cameramen on them and stuff like that. And there was a guy who directed
work.
Them. Yeah, you know, I mean.
You know,
I don't know. You know, I guess I
the worst job in porno is the fluff girls.
Right.
They have the worst job. You know, keeping the guys hard. But they don't need to do that anymore because
AI.
Of the Viagra.
I wonder if,
no, because of Viagra.
Would it benefit
like
me to get a job on that if I told people that I shook Ron Jeremy's hand? Or would it
probably
hinder?
Couldn't hurt.
Couldn't
you
hurt.
Know, you know, one thing I've thought about, I noticed in all the people who work as set dressers, there's a lot of musicians who work. Now, I have a theory. Tell me if this bears out. So, musicians from an early age, I mean, I've started training on this when I was the band boy in my father's band, and
right.
then all through being a musician myself, you learn to walk around a lot of equipment that could easily be knocked down. There's a lot of wires that you could trip over. So, and also it's in tight quarters and you're around each other and you just through practice, you figure out how to not bump in anybody,
right.
how to give everybody way, you know, like as like, just it's a negotiation.
I totally disagree. I just think you're just very flamboyant.
You know what it is, though?
Like, I don't get that.
A buddy of mine.
I think it's gay.
Okay.
A guy, Sid, that we work with, you know, he's also he's a rock and roll musician, and he's a set dresser. And he, you know, he's an unsung hero. This is the guy who, are you guys familiar with who Phil Anselmo is?
The
singer
for
Pantera.
Yeah.
Well, you know, before he joined Pantera, he sang for a local band called Razor White. They were like a hair metal band.
Okay.
And Sid, I work with him still, you know, and he was friends with all these guys growing up. He was older than me. But he's the guy who told me a story. He goes, man, you don't want to take advice from me. I'm the guy who told Phil, like, man, don't go to Dallas and join that band. You know, you got a good thing here with Razor White, you know. And of course, next day he left and became a millionaire, you know. But Sid, oh, man, I lost my train of thought.
We're talking about set dressing and moving around.
But
Sid,
it's, you know, put it perfectly. He said it's kind of like being on tour, you know, because we hop into a truck, like a movie truck with a bunch of furniture.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, and so it's like the tour because you're in the close quarters of the truck. You know, sometimes you got, you know, the Teamster might be like a super Trumper guy or whatever, you know, a guy you don't agree with. But you got to get along, right? Because you got to be with this guy for months, you know, like riding his truck with him. And you got to keep the truck clean. You know, you can't just, you know, be a slob, you know, you got. It's shared space, you know, and then you show up at the set, you know, and then you're pulling furniture off, and it's like performing. It's like showing up at the club, you know,
right?
You're unloading the gear.
It's very similar skill set.
Yeah, and then like sometimes you're setting up things fast because the camera's coming in and you got to get it set up, you know, for the shot and all this stuff. So it's that's your performance because the camera crew's watching you perform. You're setting it up in front of, yeah, not all the time, but sometimes you're doing it to camera, you know, and so that's the performance, you know, and then boom, like that, it's done, you know? And then it's like, you know, and then you, you know, you, it's, so it's, it is kind of like, you know, it is like, it's the showbiz kind of, you know, like get in, get out, you know, it's like when you're playing in a club and you got a, you got a 30
also,
minute set. You
also,
know?
You're around all these cables and shit.
Oh, yeah.
Know,
and you got to be, you got to nimbly, you know, you, yeah. you want to knock over, you know, stuff. Right, it's right, really right. embarrassing.
Can't be a bull in a china closet
no.
around all
No,
that
and
shit.
We work with guys that are, and it, and yeah, it's, you know, it's,
see, I used to work at the studios back in LA.
Oh, right.
Sunset Gower, right?
Yeah, Sunset. And I, you know, I the problem I have with TV and film, and I think music also, it's just too much waiting around.
It's hours
and hours. This is why movies cost so much money, because there's too much waiting around. Well, you're paying these guys, union cats, $30 an hour
stupid
to
money,
do,
right.
do nothing.
Well, it,
wait
it,
and wait
it's
and
a
wait
dream
and
killer.
Wait.
It, yeah. it, you know, like when you think about like we were saying, a lot of musicians or set dressers, it's also like documentary filmmakers, writers, actors, you know, people that do independent stuff, but they right. all, we're all kind of a, how would you say it? I guess we're a slave to the money. So we want the money. So we're going to, yeah. we're going to put up with this, and we're going to put our own dreams on the side to like, you know, to create somebody
yeah,
else's
see, what
dream
I never understood
that's got
was,
more money.
Like,
got to make your daily bread.
You got to make it. Yeah.
I've worked behind and in front of the camera. I've acted
yeah.
and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
What I don't understand is, as an actor, I mean, this is the biggest bullshit ever, and I've walked off of some stuff. They tell you, okay, your call time's 6 a.m. All right, I show up at 6 a.m., and I wait till 4 o'clock in the
oh.
afternoon to go in front of the camera.
Oh, it's...
Why am I here for 10 hours?
Oh, man, it happens.
Your time is not as important.
And it always...
As
you know what always happens to me
well,
is
somebody,
like...
If, no, I've walked off. I've done some, like, music videos,
right.
you know, as an actor.
Right.
Featured player and music video. And like, 4 o'clock comes around, I go, I'm out of here. I don't care.
I'm done. I don't care where you're
I,
at.
I don't
yeah.
care. You can find someone else.
No, well, it's you know...
It's bullshit.
We would, you know, it always works. It still happens to me. Like, I'll if I got anything going on with Suplex, and, you know, granted, now we, you know, Suplex is almost back to being a local band.
So I was
going
to say, just to pivot, the downturn in the movie business has allowed you to devote more time to Suplex again.
Yes. Yeah, it has. We're writing a new record. We found yet another record label.
Nice.
That's interesting is Ripple Music. We're talking with those guys about putting the next one out. We spent this summer, which I haven't worked all summer. My last movie job ended in the beginning of June, so I've been off. I've been using the GarageBand. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if you ever used that. I mean, but
sure,
man,
that's how we mix these.
Oh yeah, well there you go.
Yeah,
I mean, it's you know. I mean, I used to have a 4-track recorder and like somebody's bar guitar and a pedal, and then I have some side drum machine. All would just kind of convey like some kind of idea to my band, you know. Whereas now, man, with GarageBand, I mean, you could just like it's so easy and just
yeah,
you know, non-linear. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, doing some of those things, you know, to show the band, and then we record stuff with the GarageBand too. Like we'll do like a live take, and then I'll go back and I can layer vocals over it or
right.
something,
oh,
or
yeah, yeah.
you know, put more guitars, you
yeah.
know, whatever, you know. And it's just it's such a game changer. But yeah, I know I'm rambling on.
No, it's okay. We're kind of winding down here. We're almost on the back nine of the podcast. Just the last couple of things I want to bring up. You're a guy who plays. Gibson grabber
yes,
basses.
I do.
And there's not a ton of guys who play those grabber
no,
basses.
No, no.
But you, DC Harbold, who's a former podcast guest, two-time
right.
podcast guest, and this guy, T-Bone Walk.
Okay, yeah.
Who played on the Saturday Night Live band for a long time,
uh-huh.
played on a lot of those Hall & Oates records.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Great bass player.
Mm-hmm.
But he loved those Gibson grabbers
yeah,
too.
You know, the story with the grabber is I used to play a Fender P bass,
uh-huh.
73. I bought it from Jimmy Glickman back in the day. You know, my
right
first
on.
Real bass, a boat neck 70s
God rest
model.
His soul.
Yeah, God, I mean, God bless him. You
Jimmy
know,
Jimmy Glickman, we love you.
Hey, buddy. You know, has that bass treat?
Yeah,
you know,
that's pretty good. I don't have a Jimmy Glickman imitation, but that's pretty good.
But man, I had this, you know, Fender bass, you know, and of course it had the boat neck, so it was good for tuning. You could tune it down like in different tunes. tunings, okay. right? Because could hold, because that neck was thick.
Right.
But then when I was on tour and ran across a buddy of mine who had to get out of playing in a band because he was having a kid, and he used to play a Gibson Grabber. And I said, man, you know, he's like, I'm getting out of, you know, I'm having a kid, so I'm quitting. I said, what are you doing with that Grabber? And he said, you want to buy it? And I said, I do. And he sold it to me for like $200.
Nice.
And so I bought it, and that was my first one. And I've done broke the neck on that one, but I've bought another one years later. And then in 2013, they made a new model with it used to have a slidable pickup. They made one with three mounted pickups in it.
Oh, okay.
And I bought that one. I got it through a record deal, through a record label. I got it half price through Sweetwater. Nice. So I'm still paying like $1,000 on it. But yeah, and that's what I play. And I like the tone on it, man. You know, it's got a thin neck, man. You can jump, or you can headbang with it. You know,
cool.
It's cool. And it's just different. You know, it's got the fine V headstock. You know.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's a unique unique piece for sure. It's instantly recognizable.
Like I got to tell you a quick story about this place, though.
All right,
and I don't know how it doesn't fit into anything we were talking about. Maybe it fit in early with the we were talking, but Snake and Jake's. This is my I always tell this story about Snake and Jake's. Back in the 90s, Trent Reznor lived here, right? The Nine Inch Nails
in New
guy,
Orleans, right?
And
right.
He had on Magazine Street a recording studio. Which was an old funeral home converted into a recording studio.
Right, the Laughlin Funeral Home.
Yes, and which happened to be, it was in my family, the Wallins. That was my great grandparents.
Oh, okay.
So,
on Magazine Street.
Yeah, corner, right across from Buddha Belly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't notice till like recently that was in my family. I didn't know it when he was here. But he had this studio, and in that studio is where the band Marilyn Manson recorded, you know. Now, I'm not a big Marilyn Manson fan at all, you know. But back in the 90s, everybody would see Trent Reznor around town. So one night I'm in here, and
Beautiful
I'm sitting.
Beautiful People is a pretty cool song,
right? But one night I'm in here, and I'm sitting down at that end of the bar, you know, and he walks in naked. A bunch of goth people come in, right?
Uh-huh.
And they all crowd right behind me. I'm in that, I'm sitting at the bar, and they're in that corner right back over there, uh-huh. And they're all behind me, and it's nobody in here, and it's unnerving. And I know it's Trent Reznor's here because they're all going, "Hey Trent, Trent and Trent this," and so of course I'm like, "All right, Trent Reznor's in here, but I'm gonna get out of here, because this is weird." And they're all behind me. It's like they could jump me or
right.
Turn me into a vampire. I don't know.
Sure.
So I was like, let me get out of here. So I finished my beer, but of course I'm gonna do the old turnaround, right? I'm gonna get a glimpse of Trent Reznor. Right. Whatever. I'm not,
why not?
Starstruck, but whatever, I'm gonna check him out.
Sure.
And I get up and turn around, and I don't see Trent Reznor, but what I do see, and this is before I knew who they were, is the singer for Marilyn Manson in the full Beautiful People, the whited out eye,
right, seven foot
tall boots, gawking over that, unnaturally tall,
shaven eyebrows,
white face, the whole full guard. I mean, right. And that's what I turned out. It literally scared me. I'm not ashamed to admit. I mean, I remember I walked out of here and I was like, and I knew it was, goth people, but I was
you
like,
you should see him now. He's scary.
Yeah. But I was like, man, I got on my bike. I was riding home and I lived in the neighborhood. I'm like, man, this goth thing is just, it's wild, man. And I didn't know who it was at the time, but then I saw the video, because back then it was still when MTV had videos, and I was like, singer, that's Marilyn Manson,
Well, he used to date that really hot chick. What was her name?
Oh, I know.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, she
with the cute,
she showed up.
Christina Ricci.
No, not Christina Ricci.
Well, he did.
I thought that was.
No, it was that other chick who showed up at the MTV Awards, basically.
Barbara Walters. No.
that's a Manny Chevrolet line. Okay.
That's a Manny Chevrolet answer.
Davita Tease, was that it?
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. All right, well.
But it was great to see him, though. He was in that movie Long Legs.
I haven't seen
that. Oh, was he?
Oh, yeah, he was fabulous.
Who, Trent?
Marilyn Manson. Yeah,
yeah. I just watched a movie that Trent did the whole soundtrack for. He's got quite a career as a score.
I know he did Natural Born Killers.
He did one that I saw last week.
Oh, wow.
He's quite...
Natural Born Losers.
When he did the Johnny Cash song, it's Johnny, when Johnny Cash covered his song.
Yeah.
It's like Johnny Cash.
Cash covered Marilyn Manson?
Trent Reznor.
Trent Reznor.
He did Hurt.
It was like his
Rick Rubin records. Yeah.
And it was a really Yeah, I thought it was great.
Very successful recording.
Right, you know what I mean?
Rick Rubin, he's that homeless guy, right?
He looks like a homeless guy.
Yeah, he's under the bridge.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to cut this off because we're...
Good.
Yeah. Because Manny has things to do.
Yeah, I got things to do.
Well, I got to go. God, Danny, this is so fun, man.
I'm so happy we finally got to do this for today.
Absolutely. And like Paul Masson and
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles would say for Paul Masson, no wine before it's time.
So, right.
You know, no.
Yeah, exactly. This right. You know, get a few more stories in there.
There
right?
you go. Well, thank you so much for
coming on.
And as always on the Troubled Men podcast, we'd like to say trouble never ends.
But the struggle continues. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
Been living on a dime, on a gospel friend.